Here's our series on aging in Portland. Retired or rewired? What it's like getting old in a youth-centered city. Are you up for that challenge? We'll bring you lots of views, but you'll have to answer this question for yourself. Is Portland a good place in which to grow old? This is the 16th episode in KBOO's series on what it's like to age in Portland. We call it Retired or Rewired. Today we're talking with Vicky Kind. She's a clinical bioethicist, professional speaker, and hospice volunteer. Her award-winning book, The Caregiver's Path to Compassionate Decision-Making, Making Choices for Those Who Can't, guides families, conservators, and other professionals through the difficult process of making decisions for those who have lost their capacity. Her newly released book, The Caregiver's Path, Resource Workbook, Conversation Guide, and Visual Toolkit, provides communication tools for managing challenging conversations with families and patients. Vicky, yes. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you for having me. I am so excited to be able to speak to the people in Portland.
Your focus isn't just on the elderly. You deal with cognitive impairment, dementia, stroke, and other problems of thinking. How much of your work is with the elderly?
So when I wrote my book originally, I made sure that it wasn't just about aging, because the idea of helping someone with diminished capacity or lacking mental capacity, that can happen at any age. It can be someone with a developmental disability that maybe they're 30 years old now, but when they were born, their brain never developed into someone that might be mentally 18. And so that person will need someone supporting and watching out for them throughout their life. Or it might be someone that comes back from the war with a traumatic brain injury, and that person might be 20. So most of my work is with those who are older, but incapacity can hit us at any time. The focus can't just be on the patient. It needs to be on the whole family.
You talk about four tools to use when making the difficult life, health, and end-of-life decisions. Tell us what they are and how you use them.
So these are wonderful tools, and I first learned how to use them, you know, as a bioethicist, but I started using them in my personal life when I was taking care of my dad, who had vascular dementia, and his mental abilities were that of somebody maybe 7 years old. And so the four tools and the way they worked for my dad, the first one is called the decision-making framework. And this tool helps to make sure that we are respecting the person's wishes when we know them. So I made sure that I honored my dad's wishes. And then there's different techniques within this framework that help us know what to do when we don't know what the person would want and we're just doing the best we can. The second tool I think is my favorite. It's called the shared decision-making model. And what this says is, depending on the person's mental age, people have a larger or smaller voice in their own decisions. So this actually comes from pediatric ethics. In pediatric medicine, what we do is we allow children who are 14 to 17 years old mentally, not just physically, but their mental abilities, quite a bit of voice and sometimes a full decision-making power in their medical decisions. Somebody that's 7 to 13, they'll probably have some voice, some choice, but you're certainly not going to let an 8-year-old make serious medical decisions. The third tool is the sliding scale for decision making, and it works with the tool that I just described, where it says based on the person's mental age, we can let them make more dangerous decisions or less dangerous. So the higher the level of capacity, the more serious or consequential the decision they can make. As their mental ability decreases, then we want to make sure we're only giving them easier, less consequential decisions. And this one really gives families and caregivers the confidence to know I'm doing the right thing, because I'm letting them have power and control when it's safe, but I'm stepping in when I need to.
Important distinctions. And the fourth one.
The fourth tool is called the ascent tool, and we use it when somebody is maybe in the 7 to 13 year range. And this is a tool where we let them have some voice over parts of the decision. So for instance, when I was moving my dad into an assisted living that had a dementia area, he didn't make the decision that he needed to move because his mental ability was 7, right? So I had to make the decision. I had to make sure there was enough money in his accounts. I had to make sure that they had good nurses there. But I could allow him to decide whether or not he wanted to bring his favorite chair, which clothes he wanted to bring.
Vicki, all this, these four criteria and their application depend on your determination of someone's mental age. Is that right?
Yes.
And how do you do that? Is there a test, a written test, or a verbal test, or what?
So a lot of times people hope that their doctor can do this for them, but realistically, doctors don't know the patient like family members do. And when I say family, it could be friends, it could be whomever's caring for this person, because we don't all have the same traditional families. So the person can take a look, and I give them this example. I say, would you let this person, I start using basic examples of people, are they allowed to drive? And it's like, oh no, she definitely couldn't drive. Okay, so that means she's not 15 to 16. Would you let her stay home alone? Yeah, she could stay home alone. That would be safe. So that tells me they're maybe around mentally 12, because that's when we let kids stay home alone. Versus, no, she can't even make a sandwich. Okay, well, maybe that's a four-year-old. So I have people imagine, what would you allow a child, what would you let them do, and then compare it to what you would allow the person you're caring for do.
How do you, or how does a family member know when to even step in, getting preceding this process of evaluation? How do you know when to step in and not let people make their own decisions?
Yeah, I think this one can be really challenging because a lot of times people don't want to see it. Like, I know my mom shouldn't be driving, but I don't want to have to take away the car keys. So sometimes we resist seeing it. But what we want to do is figure out, is the person safe? And an easy way that I explain this to families is, can your person connect the dots? Can they hold enough pieces of information together and remember all the details all at the same time so they can say, yes, that is a good idea, or no, that is not a good idea? So an example might be, can the person say, oh dear, there's a fire. I should leave the building. I should call 911. Those are all separate things that they have to think. It's not just memory. It's not just being. It's, can they process? Do they have what's called executive functioning?
What are the specific questions to ask when you have to make decisions about CPR, feeding tubes, and other end-of-life choices?
So one of the things I start with is, don't rush. Get lots of information. Know your options. A lot of times doctors try to push us to make a fast decision, and a lot of times it's not really an emergency. We should step back and collect information and kind of calm ourselves. And then when we think about the options, we want to look at three things. What are the risks? And you've heard doctors say this, risks and benefits. What are the benefits? And then the third that is not talked about is called the burdens. What is the burden of this decision? So the question I teach families to use is, what will it feel like and be like for Bob to experience this decision? What would it feel like and be like for Bob to live with a feeding tube, right? It's not what would it feel like to put the feeding tube in. That's a 15-minute procedure. But what's it going to feel like when he's at Thanksgiving and he can't eat his favorite food? If people would like a list of good questions to use when making medical decisions, they can feel free to go to my website at kindethics.com, and there are a lot of great resources there.
Vicki, I saw in your writing you'd sometimes teach that there are simple tests to determine what's the right thing to do.
These tests actually come from an organization called Character Counts from an amazing gentleman named Michael Josephson, and he has three of them. The first is called the publicity test. And it's not so much to tell you what is the right thing to do, but these tests are to help you feel the confidence and the strength to actually do them. The first one is the publicity test that says, what would you do if people knew what you were doing, basically, if it went viral on the internet, if people understood not only what you did, but why you did it. The second is the kid over the shoulder test. I love this one because what would you do if your kid was watching? What would you do if your kid found out that you had done blank? And the last test is the role model test. Think about a person that you admire and respect and think to yourself, what would they do? So some people say, I think about my grandmother. She was such a fine person. I think, what would grandma do? When you're not sure, what should I do? You can say, what would that person do?
Vicki Kind, we're going to leave it at that. Your voice of empathy is most welcome here.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate this opportunity.
In the next episode, we'll be talking with Dr. Lisa McGuire of the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta. She'll tell us about the growing incidence of Alzheimer's in the U.S. and what the CDC is doing about it. Don't miss it. You've been listening to our series on aging in Portland, retired or rewired. You can listen to any episode in this series or the entire series if you go to kboo.fm and look for the show under my name, Tom Flynn. Thanks for joining us today.